In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@macmac.com.
We're going to talk about Greg Grandin's book, Empire's Workshop, Latin America, the United States, and the Rise of the New Imperialism, introduction through chapter 3. Tonight, I'm going to stress Grandin's discussion of U.S. imperialism in Latin America after World War II, with a few comments about FDR's good neighbor policy, and a few comments about Woodrow Wilson, the godfather of 20th century U.S. imperialism. Preparing this lecture was emotionally difficult for a number of reasons. One, in terms of my anguish and rage as I read the discussion of the genocidal levels of U.S.-sponsored Nazi-like terror in Central and the rest of Latin America, and also thinking about friends of mine who were victims of U.S. imperialism in Chile. The U.S. supported coup on September 11, 1973, a 9/11 date that few here in the United States remember, led to the murder, torture, and disappearance of thousands of Chileans and the forced exile of hundreds of thousands more. One of those exiled was Orlando Letelier, who was a minister for Allende, who came to the United States and became active in the opposition to the Pinochet regime, so much so that Pinochet ordered his assassination. Letelier was killed in a car bombing on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., planned by CIA agent Michael Townley and actually executed by anti-Castro Cuban exiles on September 21, 1976. With him that morning were Michael Moffitt, a dear friend of mine and a student at the college where I taught, and Ronnie Carpen Moffitt, his wife. I had attended their wedding the previous May and returned in September for Ronnie's funeral. Michael was injured but survived. And now to Grandin, who writes that prior to World War II, the United States had sent gunboats into Latin American ports over 6,000 times. I mean, that figure just blew my mind. Had invaded a number of countries, fought protracted guerrilla wars in others, annexed Puerto Rico, and taken part of Colombia to create both Panama and the Panama Canal. But decades of mounting Latin American resistance, including armed resistance, forced a brief improvement under FDR, who promised that the U.S. would be a good neighbor. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz criticizes Grandin's view a bit on this soft imperialism under FDR in a review of his book in the Monthly Review. The good neighbor policy was an extension of imperialism by other means, she argues, and the poor continued to suffer while the rulers got richer. She regrets that Grandin apparently believes that soft imperialism is acceptable, echoing following the argument of William Appleman Williams about empire as a way of life that is so deeply ingrained that its absence entirely is unimaginable. Grandin's analysis of this period, in her view, does not confront imperialism as an extension of and inherent to capitalism. The present global crisis, she argues, does not exist because the system is not working. It exists because that's the way the system works. Although Grandin rightly dates U.S. imperialism in Latin America to the founding of the United States, Dunbar Ortiz faults him for not discussing the conquest and colonization of the indigenous communities and nations of the North American continent. He should have provided some context for this early history by sharing Williams' list of U.S. military interventions and occupations in empire as a way of life. And you remember the appendices in Williams' book where he lists all these interventions and occupations. These include the first of several Barbary Coast Wars, followed with the war against Tripoli from 1801 to 1805, that is etched into the Marine anthem, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. The U.S. also invaded Spanish Mexico in 1806, seized Spanish Western Florida in 1810, attacked Spanish East Florida in 1812, and took Pensacola, Florida in 1814. These U.S. attacks reveal that the empire existed prior to the Spanish-American War that many historians mark as beginning the age of imperialism and the protection of American interests. Dunbar Ortiz reminds us that those interests were commercial and economic, that is, capitalistic. Exporting capitalism is how the system works, she says, and that's called imperialism. It's not a dysfunction. Despite her critical comments, she lauds Grandin's analysis of how Latin America informs us about post-9/11 U.S. foreign policy. He does this extremely well. Indeed, his conclusion is a tour de force showing that the present policy would be impossible were it not for U.S. practices in Latin America, particularly the Reagan administration's practice and lessons learned in Central America. This soft imperialist period under FDR was short-lived. And as the Cold War began, security forces trained, funded, equipped, and incited by the U.S. unleashed a brain of bloody terror from which the region has yet to recover. This truth is backed by indisputable historical evidence that has been buried under decades of lies from government officials and apologies from mass media pundits. After World War II, Grandin claims the U.S. undermined its own good neighbor policies by opposing those who struggled for democracy and reform governments that threatened U.S. hegemony. It was actually the ruling elites here in the U.S. that were threatened, since the American public was not asked for its views and mostly fell into line behind the emerging Cold War anti-communist view. The U.S. ruling class opposed reform and the labor militancy throughout Latin America. This class demanded protection from the U.S. government, therefore, and deepened its links with Latin America's landed class, Catholic Church, and military, which took advantage of the U.S.'s new Cold War policy to launch a continental counter-revolution against democratic struggles and reform governments throughout Latin America. This imperialist effort was aided by the formation of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1947. Its first major act in Latin America was the overthrow in 1954 of Guatemalan President Jacobo Arbenz, who was simply trying to implement a New Deal-style economic program to modernize and humanize that country's brutal plantation economy. But even this modest reform was too much for the rich there and their corporate and political sponsors here. This coup, however, was followed by a defeat for U.S. hegemony in 1959 with the Cuban Revolution. The events in these two countries, according to Grandin, polarized politics throughout the hemisphere and inflamed a generation of activists who would later challenge U.S. imperialism in Chile, El Salvador, and Nicaragua, among other countries. John F. Kennedy dramatically increased U.S. imperialism in Latin America, something that liberal admirers of the late president refuse to acknowledge. He campaigned in the 1960 presidential election as a committed militarist and promised to establish a new foundation on which to ensure the continuance of American power in such changing times. He attempted to maintain U.S. hegemony throughout the hemisphere in the face of powerful movements for radical change. The key was to appear to support the ideals of these movements, while at the same time deepening U.S. militarism against them. Despite his image as an idealist, it was during Kennedy's era that national security states in Latin America, strengthened and in some cases created by the U.S., began to transform themselves into command centers of the region's death squad system, which executed hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans and tortured tens of thousands more. This is an absolutely critical point. The real, as opposed to the fantasy, Kennedy helped lay the groundwork for later genocidal levels of violence throughout the region. Historian Richard Walton has analyzed Kennedy's foreign policies in Latin America in his book Cold War and Counter-Revolution. Walton argues that the context for Kennedy's aggression in Latin America and his terrorist acts against Cuba are to be found in Cold War efforts to increase U.S. military superiority over the Soviet Union. Immediately after his inauguration in 1961, Kennedy moved to increase U.S. military strength across the board, including a dramatic jump in the nuclear missile program. This was barely 2 weeks after Eisenhower warned us about the dangers of the military-industrial complex in his farewell address. JFK asked for huge increases in military spending, despite intelligence studies that revealed there was no missile gap with the Soviet Union. Walton asserts that Kennedy also shared the view of other U.S. presidents, such as Teddy Roosevelt, that is, the U.S. has the unique right to intervene by force of arms in the domestic affairs of other nations. This arrogant view became a cardinal tenet of U.S. policy after World War II under both Democrats and Republicans. The U.S. reserved this right for itself, but was quick to condemn any nation acting in a similar manner, for example, criticizing Soviet actions in Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia in 1968. Kennedy was obsessed with Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution, approving Operation Mongoose that included assassination attempts against Fidel and terrorist attacks against that nation. To undermine Cuban influence in Latin America, Kennedy combined violence with the rhetoric of democratic concern, for example, the Alliance for Progress. The rhetoric, however, was aimed here at home against U.S. citizens, since he never intended to attack the deep-seated social and economic injustices throughout Latin America. His imperialist, class-based policies were continued by Johnson and Nixon, and culminated in the genocidal U.S.-supported death squad regimes under President Reagan. Kennedy was so obsessed with Fidel Castro that he advocated actions that were even criticized by then-Vice President Nixon during their campaign debates. Nixon stating, "Senator Kennedy's policies and recommendations for the handling of the Castro regime are probably the most dangerously irresponsible recommendations that he's made. We have treaties with Latin America," Nixon said, "in which we've agreed not to intervene in the internal affairs of any other American country. The Charter of the United Nations also provides that there shall be no intervention in the internal affairs of another. If we were to follow his, Kennedy's, recommendation, we would lose all of our friends in Latin America and probably be condemned in the UN. Now, Nixon's response to Kennedy's assertions, of course, it was totally disingenuous because Eisenhower had already approved a CIA plan to overthrow the Castro government at that time. Kennedy supported the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in April 1961, proving in Walton's view that he was prepared to violate the territorial integrity of a sovereign state and violate international law, as well as an American pledge not to intervene in the domestic affairs of hemispheric states. In a public statement shortly after the invasion in April 1961, Kennedy lied about U.S. involvement, and I quote, "Any unilateral American intervention in the absence of an external attack upon ourselves or an ally would have been contrary to our traditions and to our international obligation." He made this statement before major U.S. newspaper editors. Not one confronted him on this egregious distortion of the truth in keeping with the mass media's lapdog tradition of supporting U.S. aggression. Walton writes that this was an extraordinary statement that Kennedy made. Not only was the invasion planned by the U.S., but the U.S. recruited, paid, and trained an exile force that had American military equipment and were trained by American military men. The warplanes were American, flown by Americans. American ships carried the invaders, and American naval units accompanied them. Americans were killed in the operation. To claim that America, he really means the United States of America, did not intervene was to lie and be caught in a lie. But these lies and the blatant violation of both international and U.S. law did not arouse much public protest here in the United States. As polls revealed, almost 80% of the U.S. public supported Kennedy's action, proving once again that brainwashed citizens can be led to give their allegiance to political demagogues and outrageous imperialist policies. Walton challenges the so-called crowning achievement of Kennedy's administration, JFK's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 1962. Although it has been called Kennedy's greatest triumph, Walton profoundly disagrees. He states, "Kennedy's decision to go to the brink of nuclear war was irresponsible and reckless to a supreme degree. He consciously risked nuclear catastrophe." I totally agree with Walton's harsh indictment of Kennedy. JFK's terrorist policies against Cuba, culminating with the Bay of Pigs invasion, were the major cause of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It convinced Castro and Khrushchev that Cuba was in serious danger from the United States, and evidence supports the wisdom of that perception. When one looks objectively and honestly, without blinders, at JFK's record of infamy in Latin America, the numerous assassination attempts on Castro's life, and hundreds of terrorist acts against Cubans, which went far beyond Kennedy's era, of course, and have killed more people in Cuba in the last 47 years than the number of U.S. citizens killed in 9/11, and the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the missile crisis, and U.S. efforts to destabilize the government in British Guiana, now Guyana, the refusal to support the elected Dominican leader Juan Bosch when he was overthrown by a military coup in September 1963, and national security state violence throughout Latin America, they reveal John F. Kennedy as a violent leader who was a supporter of entrenched class rule in Latin America. In their analysis of contemporary U.S. imperialism, writers and activists John Bellamy Foster and Robert McChesney, in their book Pax Americana, also place the recent history of U.S. aggression in Latin America in the context of the Kennedy era. In a June 1963 speech, Kennedy declared that the U.S. sought peace in the world, not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. He dismissed as wholly baseless and incredible as Marxist propaganda the charge that the U.S. was engaged in imperialism in Latin America and elsewhere. Imagine that. It was just Marxist propaganda. The facts prove otherwise, including his administration and continuing to the present. Covert and outright U.S. imperialist actions in Latin America have included attacks against Cuba, British Guiana, the Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile, Argentina, Grenada, Colombia, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, Haiti, and Venezuela, and I may have missed a few countries in this list. Foster and McChesney contend that we must look to underlying capitalist profit motives as the foundation for imperialism in Latin America. Its aim has always been to open up investment opportunities to U.S. corporations and allow them to gain preferential access to crucial natural resources. The empire must, therefore, oppose all attempts to change the status quo in the periphery of the system, if not in the center as well. For these reasons, militarism and imperialism are inseparable for U.S. capitalism, as they are for capitalism as a whole. Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon continued Kennedy's policies, and Nixon was president when the U.S. helped to overthrow the democratically elected Allende government in Chile in 1973. U.S. terrorism in Latin America, however, reached new and genocidal levels under Ronald Reagan. But this shift did not begin abruptly with Reagan, however, and Grandin rightly criticizes Jimmy Carter's administration as the transition stage through the horrendous Reagan policies. And I quote, "A number of Carter's actual policies facilitated the rearming of the Cold War that his successor Reagan would execute in full. It was Carter, not Reagan, who began to increase the military budget at the expense of domestic social services. It was Carter who first proposed the creation of a rapid deployment force that was designed, according to his NSC advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, to strike against brewing trouble. It was Carter who initiated support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan 6 months prior to the Soviet invasion in 1979. And it was Carter who began America's more active military engagement in the Persian Gulf. It was called the Carter Doctrine. The full flowering of imperialist aggression in the hemisphere, however, came in Central America with Reagan and his advisors' advocacy for U.S.-supported death squad regimes and the Contras. Although these U.S.-supported forces were truly mad dog killers, Reagan lauded them all, even going so far as to call the Contras the moral equivalents of America's founding fathers. He patronized brutal executioners and torturers to the point that Grandin argues where mass slaughter became a crucial instrument of U.S. foreign policy. Grandin forces us to see the horrific nature and levels of violence that formed the U.S. imperialism in Central America. The terror in Guatemala, for example, was absolutely staggering, as perhaps 100,000 Mayan peasants were slaughtered by an army that had been trained by the United States and Israel. Troops murdered children by beating them on rocks or throwing them in rivers as their parents watched. They gutted living victims, amputated genitalia, arms and legs, committed mass rapes, and buried victims alive. These were the freedom fighters lauded by Reagan and his supporters. In truth, they were brothers kin to the Nazi SS that slaughtered Jews and others along the Eastern Front in World War II. El Salvador was more of the same, and the terror there unfolded when the U.S.-supported regime responded to the cries for reform by increasing death squads executions that united and radicalized the opposition. Officials in the Carter administration were informed about and knowledgeable about these death squad massacres, but there was little outrage from our patron saint of human rights or his advisors. Kennedy's policies had actually helped to lay the foundation for what ultimately became the death squad regimes in El Salvador and Guatemala. For example, even though there was not even a whiff, Grandin says, of rural insurrection in El Salvador in the 1960s, this did not stop agents from the State Department, Green Berets, CIA, and USAID that organized groups that would become the backbone of that country's death squad system. Led by soldiers who were often trained by the United States at Fort Benning, Georgia. A Pentagon report stated it was precisely the young, aggressive, U.S.-trained officers who were the most intoxicated by the extreme right's vision and who commit many of the worst atrocities. In Guatemala, Grandin tells us the bloodshed was even worse. After the CIA overthrew Arbenz in 1954, Washington promised that it would turn the country into a showcase for democracy. Where have we heard that? But instead created a laboratory of repression. In the early 1980s, the military devastated indigenous areas, turning them into a slaughterhouse. When U.S. aid was partly cut to these death squad regimes and the Contras in Nicaragua, Argentina and Israel stepped in with training and weapons. It may seem shocking that Israel joined the anti-Semitic Argentine generals in funding and organizing this genocide, something that should be remembered the next time Israeli officials and their supporters in the U.S. attempt to lecture us about terrorism. Despite full knowledge of the genocidal nature of what was happening in Guatemala, however, Reagan continued to laud a regime whose troops engaged in large-scale killing of Indian men, women, and children. The same butchery was pursued in Nicaragua against the Sandinistas that had taken power in a genuine people's revolution in 1979, overthrowing the criminal Somoza family that had been supported by the U.S. since the Good Neighbor days under FDR. Oliver North and William Casey, head of the CIA, led the U.S. terrorist efforts. They organized and presided over an elaborate transnational support network designed to bypass congressional and public scrutiny. The network included nations such as Saudi Arabia and Israel, conservative religious leaders and organizations, private security firms and arms merchants, mercenaries, ex-agents of SAVAK, the Shah of Iran's secret police, and international drug dealers. Grandin tells us there was ample evidence that the CIA employed dealers as middlemen, using their planes to ship arms to the Contras in exchange for easy access to American markets. All of these people and groups were evidently part of the moral leaders and freedom fighters that Reagan talked about. Official U.S. reports, however, usually kept from the public, prove that the Contras committed atrocities that included thousands of civilian murders, mutilations, tortures, and rapes, of which the CIA superiors were well aware. The agency stated that the Contras killed civilians and Sandinista officials, as well as heads of cooperatives, nurses, doctors, and judges. By the end of the war, 30,000 civilians had been killed, the overwhelming majority at the hands of this U.S.-sponsored and supported terrorist group. Despite our moral revulsion over this terror, that is, some of us, our moral revulsion, we must understand that it was absolutely necessary to maintain U.S. imperial hegemony. Otherwise, U.S.-backed Contras and death squad regimes in Guatemala and El Salvador would have been overthrown along with their U.S. patrons who rule those nations for generations. Others have seconded Grandin's arguments. In 1982, for example, the writer and Nobel laureate Gabriel Garcia Marquez discussed the human cost of U.S.-sponsored terror in Latin America in his Nobel acceptance speech. Since the early 1970s, he said, the continent had not had a moment's rest. There were 5 wars and 17 military coups. There emerged a diabolic dictator who was carrying out, in God's name, the first Latin American genocide of our time. He was referring to General Rios Montt in Guatemala, Reagan's favorite. Marquez continued, those missing because of repression number nearly 120,000 people. Because people tried to change the state of affairs, nearly 200,000 women and men have died throughout the continent, and over 100,000 have lost their lives in Nicaragua, El Salvador, and Guatemala. 1 million have fled Chile, 10% of its population. Uruguay, a tiny nation of 2.5 million inhabitants that considers itself this continent's most civilized country, has lost to exile 1 out of every 5 citizens. These horrific crimes against humanity that were punishable by death at Nuremberg were all carried out with U.S. financial, ideological, and military assistance. In his history of U.S. imperial relations with Latin America, the scholar Juan Gonzalez, in his book, A Harvest of Empire, reminds us that the violent repression in the 1960s through the 1980s had deep historical roots going back to the earliest assaults by whites against Spanish colonies. And the policies carried out by Kennedy, Reagan, and others were linked back to the racist militarism of that godfather of imperialism, Woodrow Wilson. When he became president in 1912, U.S. corporations owned hundreds of plants in Mexico, the Caribbean, and Central America, and millions of peasants had been forced from their lands. Even though they did not freely choose it, Puerto Ricans became citizens, U.S. citizens, in 1917, when Congress passed an act making them so over the unanimous protests of their House of Delegates. This was the year the U.S. entered World War I, 1917, an abject history lesson that revealed the utter bankruptcy of Wilson's proclaimed ideals about self-determination that were never meant to apply to people of color around the world. One of Wilson's idealistic efforts on behalf of self-determination occurred in 1916, when the U.S. invaded the Dominican Republic, dissolved its legislature, imposed martial law and press censorship, and jailed hundreds of opponents. The occupation would last 8 years and prompted widespread protests against the United States throughout Latin America, created deep bitterness in the Dominican population, and radically altered every sphere of Dominican society. Lyndon Johnson followed Wilson's example in May 1965 when he sent Marines there to block the election and return of progressive candidate Juan Bosch. The very same month, Johnson was escalating the war in Vietnam. Noam Chomsky, our leading intellectual dissident, has argued that all this terror in Latin America must be understood as part of a larger effort by the United States to retain its global domination after World War II. In his book, Hegemony or Survival, he points out that grasping U.S. efforts during the Cold War means understanding that foreign policy flows from an institutional framework of domestic power which remains fairly stable. Economic decision-making in the U.S. is highly centralized. And it is only natural, he argues, that state policy should seek to construct a world system open to U.S. economic penetration and political control, tolerating no rivals or threats. U.S. imperialism in pursuit of this grand strategy, therefore, has always been primarily aimed at third world nationalist and radical movements in places like Latin America, not primarily aimed at the Soviet Union. He develops this argument in his book, World Orders Old and New, asserting that U.S. imperialism has sought to maintain the worldwide class division between North and South, which is far more important than the East-West Cold War conflict. He says that the conventional picture of the Cold War does not withstand scrutiny and never has. A much more realistic understanding of the Cold War can be obtained by adopting a longer-range perspective, viewing it as one particular phase in the 500-year European conquest of the world. The history of aggression, subversion, terror, and domination, now termed the North-South confrontation. The evidence for this North-South imperialist thesis, Chomsky points out, is spelled out with particular lucidity in U.S. planning documents and illustrated in practice with much consistency. In these documents, independent nationalism, and especially radical nationalism, cannot be tolerated. Latin America, for example, is to provide services for the rich, offering cheap labor, resources, markets, opportunities for investment, and lately, export of pollution, along with other amenities, Chomsky argues, such as havens for drug money laundering and other unregulated financial operations, tourism, and so on. If ultranationalism arises and appears successful in terms that might be meaningful for poor people elsewhere, then it must be opposed by the United States as a heinous crime. The culprit is then termed a virus that might spread infection elsewhere, a rotten apple that might spoil the barrel, like Arbenz's Guatemala, Allende's Chile, Sandinista Nicaragua, and a host of others. Chomsky points out that the fundamental issues are occasionally expressed with some clarity, again, in the official documents, as when Henry Kissinger warned that the contagious, it's like a disease with these people, the contagious example of Allende's Chile might infect not only Latin America, but other areas of the world. Regarding Nicaragua, Reagan's Secretary of State, George Shultz, voiced the real fear about the Sandinistas' impact on anti-imperialist struggles throughout Latin America. If they succeed in consolidating their power, he stated, then all the countries in Latin America will see radical forces emboldened to exploit these problems. In order to crush this possibility in Central America, Grandin shows us how U.S. supported death squad regimes in Guatemala and El Salvador and contra-terrorists in Nicaragua resorted to genocidal levels of violence. Chomsky has called Nicaragua a particularly revealing case that shows how torturing that country is a ritual going back to 1854, when the United States Navy destroyed a coastal town in Nicaragua to avenge an alleged insult to U.S. officials and the millionaire Cornelius Vanderbilt. It has therefore long been our established right, Chomsky says, without a second thought, through the final savagery of our client Somoza, who slaughtered tens of thousands with our aid and approval, disguised with much conceit, when the desperate population finally arose. The refusal of the new government, that is, the Sandinistas, to genuflect in the proper manner to the United States aroused sheer frenzy, especially among U.S. leaders and mass media apologists. Scholars James Petras and Henry Weltmeyer support Grandin's overall thesis by addressing the economic basis of U.S. imperialism in Latin America. They argue that U.S. imperialist aggression takes many forms but pursues similar goals: conquest of markets, penetration of competitors, and protection of home markets. This aggression has been masked in recent decades, however, under the guise of globalization, a process they argue that actually grew out of the barrel of a gun wielded, pointed, and fired by the imperialist state. Now, this assertion must be true because it's been found in the New York Times. It's been articulated by arguably the most influential U.S. journalist and certainly the biggest apologist for globalization on the planet, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times. He offered up this relationship between the capitalist market, globalization, and imperialism. And I quote, "The hidden hand of the market will never work without a hidden fist. McDonald's cannot flourish without McDonnell Douglas, the designer of the F-15. And the hidden fist that keeps the world safe for Silicon Valley's technologies is called the U.S. Army, Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps." Petras and Weltmeyer assert that whatever form imperialism takes, it entails the projection of state power in various forms to advance class or national interests and subordinate other countries to those interests. Policies to support the terrorist U.S. imperialist state, therefore, are taken both directly through the State Department, the Pentagon, and indirectly via control over financial institutions such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. This imperialist process, however, is not a policy, a conspiracy, or a product of any single administration, but a structural reality with political determinants and an economic basis. The authors caution us, however, not to see imperialism as a one-way process. While European and U.S. empire builders have exploited Latin America for most of the past half millennium, it is also true, they argue, that Latin American popular movements and national and socialist regimes have managed to significantly modify or transform their relations with the imperial states at different conjunctures. Imperialism is based on class and state relations that by nature inherently imply a process of conflict, confrontation, conquest, revolution, counter-revolution, and transformation. They argue it cannot be any other way. This empire building was aided by military coups in Brazil in 64, Bolivia in 71, Chile in 73, Argentina in 76, and civilian military coups in Uruguay in 1972 and Peru in 1993 that created the political framework and international agreements with international financial institutions that halted and reversed the national industrializing project and reform in the region, opening up Latin America to eventual conquest by U.S. and European interests. This imperialist process in the 1990s alone led to $585 billion in interest payments and profits being remitted to the center of the empire. The vast bulk of that money went to U.S. home offices. They argue that it is this foundation of violent accumulation off the backs of the people in Latin America that must be understood clearly and completely if we are to develop a reasonable and objective understanding of the new imperialism. The writer Eduardo Galeano, in his book Open Veins of Latin America, has defined this brutal accumulation process with his usual eloquent and powerful language, and I quote, he's speaking of Latin America, "Our defeat was always implicit in the victory of others. Our wealth has always generated our poverty by nourishing and the prosperity of others, the empire and their native overseers. In the colonial and neo-colonial alchemy, gold changes into scrap metal and food into poison." He goes on to write that the strength of the imperialist system as a whole rests on the necessary inequality of its parts. Therefore, it would be foolish to expect that the imperialists will provide a solution to the oppression they have produced. As a 19th century Guatemalan foreign minister once stated, simply and eloquently, "It would be strange if the remedy should come from the United States, the same place which brings us the disease." Samir Amin, director of the Third World Forum in Senegal, has also added his harsh judgment about the new and old U.S. imperialism in Latin America. In his book, The Empire of Chaos, he writes, "The intervention of the North in the affairs of the South is, in all its aspects, negative. Never have the armies of the North brought peace, prosperity, or democracy to the peoples of Latin America. In the future, as in the past, they can only bring further servitude, the exploitation of their labor, the expropriation of their riches, and the denial of their rights." And to conclude, the essence of Galeano's and Amin's views and U.S. imperialism was captured 178 years ago by the Venezuelan general and liberator Simon Bolivar, who fought for the independence from Spain of a number of Latin American nations. "The United States," he said, "seemed predestined by Providence to rain down misery on the Americas in the name of liberty." Let's take a break. Okay,
I'll go first. The three points that I picked up from both what you had said and what had been printed in the article by Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz.
Right.
The three points I wanted to touch on was the good neighbor policy, the purpose of chaos as being on purpose, and the impact of blowback. On the good neighbor policy, when we were in Havana last January, part of the experience was to realize that the U.S. ambassador's residence in Havana, Cuba, is the largest residence in any country in South America of the United States.
Wow.
Built by Franklin Roosevelt during good neighbor policy.
Wow.
It was the first thing done by Roosevelt to promote the good neighbor policy was the building, and I guess in the 30s, the early 40s, of the ambassador's residence in Havana.
Wow.
The point being that that period of the good neighbor policy under Roosevelt, vis-a-vis at least Latin America, was a tremendous watershed in the path. It came on the heels of Roosevelt being the first U.S. president to recognize the Soviet Union as a country, in 1934, when, of course, Lenin took over in 1918. We had no formal diplomatic relations until Roosevelt did that. So I would strongly recommend a return to the good neighbor policy. I think it's a basis on which, a historical basis upon which, I'll say future presidents, certainly not current, future presidents can rely on to promote very important first step towards rapprochement with many countries of the world. Second is chaos. This issue of chaos that she mentioned, I would like to ask any other folks to share their thoughts on it. But basically, she said that the result of U.S. interference, which resulted in chaos, where's the quote here, actually was not done by a mistake, but done, in fact, on purpose. And I thought that that was very apropos considering the big debate in the United States today about if we leave Iraq, there will be chaos. How can we possibly leave all the broken dishes on the floor of the China shop and walk away from it without assuming our moral responsibility, whether we should be there now or should never have been there? The fact is we're there now, and if we walked away, there would be a disaster, and it's our moral duty to prevent that from happening. So obviously, chaos was the desire in the first place. And lastly, the concept of blowback, which, of course, as we all know, the impact of all these U.S. techniques and methods that the U.S. has done in Latin America now coming back home to the United States in the form of increased oppression and repression within the country.
While I would agree with Dunbar Ortiz's comments that even during the good neighbor policy, of course, which relative to the awesome genocidal policies under Reagan is certainly better than the outright slaughter and military overthrow, etc., she was pointing out that, you know, economic imperialism continued throughout that period, and the gap between the rich and the poor. The blowback, to jump ahead to blowback, a number of you are familiar or may have read Chalmers Johnson's, he has the trilogy in his book, Blowback, Sorrows of Empire, and his new book just came out, Nemesis, The End of the American Republic, I believe. He was referring specifically to the blowback around the arming of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. As for the issue of chaos and whether these things are deliberate, well, we know, and this is, I always thought, one of the great strengths of Noam Chomsky, because Chomsky does not quote from left-wing sources. He goes right to the horse's mouth. He quotes from major documents, the rulers themselves. Conscious policies have been put in place, and especially after World War II, as opposed to unconscious policies. The rulers of this country did not unconsciously plan the Bay of Pigs invasion. They did not unconsciously decide to overthrow Arbenz in 54. They don't unconsciously decide to help Pinochet overthrow Allende. It is conscious. It is not a conspiracy in the sense, the way often we were raised to think a conspiracy, that, you know, in the dark of the night, Schultz met with North in some little diner in a quiet area of Washington where no one knew them. But it is conscious, and they know it creates chaos. And if you read Mark Danner's book, The Massacre at El Mozote, about El Salvador, or read Grandin's other book, The Last Colonial Massacre, in terms of what happened in Guatemala, the chaos created is the same chaos the Nazis created in Europe in terms of the absolute slaughter. They know it will happen, and they continue to do it. So the idea that, oh, we couldn't tell, as Jay mentioned, oh, we don't have any idea that this kind of chaos would be created in Iraq with a U.S. invasion, that's an absolute crap argument, and it has to be rejected.
Something that I found very interesting on in the workshop on page 96, he talks about General William Yarbrough and makes connections between basically the death squad's counterinsurgency strategy of the Green Beret in Vietnam, and the same individuals flying back and forth between Vietnam and, was it Guatemala? I forget. But then later on, he works with the FBI on COINTELPRO. And then leaping forward to the way they got rid of Mossadegh and the way they got rid of Arbenz was, first you create confusion, and then you make the appearance of chaos, lack of order. You make it look like there's an opposition when there isn't one, a valid one. And so here we have these guys creating this thing, and then the same bunch of people. Okay, Elliot Abrams was the ambassador to Honduras or Guatemala. Anyway, he was in charge of the death squads, and he became the ambassador in Iraq recently. And
was Negroponte.
Negroponte. Yeah. Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah.
Right.
Same guy, same bloody
right.
guy.
And lo and
different
behold,
country.
They started having all these problems with death squads there, and that. Yeah. And shortly after, they caught these British soldiers dressed up as Arabs.
running around with bombs in their car, and the Iraqi police arrested them, took them to jail, and the next thing you know, the Brits charged the jail, blew the jail up, and took their soldiers back and killed a bunch of Iraqi police. Anybody remember this? And now that same individual is not in Iraq anymore. Oh, where is he? He's in Washington again, Under Secretary of State. And in my feeling, an interesting thing, that point that the author of Christian Fascists,
Chris Hedges
was making, was that we probably, even as weak as our democracy is, we can probably hold these guys off unless we enter a period of instability. And what happened with 9/11? And all of a sudden, it was, oh, give us order, oh authoritarian one. You know, tell us what to do. Well, we'll go shop and you take care of business, okay? So I really feel that the same bunch, you know, who we see has been doing this for years and years and years. They brought it home against the civil rights movement, and they're going to use immigration, whatever. They can easily bring it home against whatever opposition we can raise against them.
Yeah.
So it's just remarkable to understand when he goes into this list, after he goes into a whole list of these guys hit the ground running under the Reagan administration.
Oh, yeah.
How to get the Contras off the ground with 79 things to do by Thursday. They're phenomenal.
Well, one of the strongest parts of this book, I believe, is the discussion of the links between some of the people who were very involved in Project Phoenix and other programs in Vietnam, with the CIA, outside of the CIA, who then show up in the Reagan administration as bloodthirsty killers and take their wares to Guatemala, to Nicaragua, the tortures, the interrogation, the throwing of, in Vietnam, just many, many cases, we don't know how many, as they then did the Argentines and the Chileans did, throwing people out of helicopters, etc. It's one of the ways you help, quote-unquote, disappear people. You take them out over the ocean. The links of those people who were veterans of Vietnam, who did 2-3 tours of duty, who then come to Washington. So in many ways, I would argue, you can't understand what the U.S. did in Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, especially in Central America, without understanding what the U.S. did in Vietnam, and even more so what the U.S. did in the Philippines in terms of torture, burning villages, etc. And then, you're right, people like Negro Ponte, who were in Honduras, Elliot Abrams, who was indicted under Iran-Contra, but nothing happened to him, are just, and that's why I mentioned the Nuremberg Tribunal. We're not talking about people here who had kind of a modest little disagreement about a policy. Well, do we send $58 million to build a cooperative in Nicaragua? Or do we send $40 million for cooperative and then we're going to help this coffee plantation? No, we're talking about people who would be right at home in the SS in terms of what they did, what they planned. And one of the extraordinary things, which is, as I said, between being anguished and being enraged, is how they were able to pull this off, and that's also a strong part of the book, in terms of the Office of Public Diplomacy, and in a brilliant, brilliant public relations campaign against a population that was clearly against direct U.S. involvement, and I'm sure many of us were on demonstrations in the 1980s. I know I was in Washington and elsewhere, and the strong opposition of many people who were Catholics in this country and some of the bishops of the Catholic Church, despite all that opposition, they were able to absolutely slaughter hundreds of thousands of people, destroy the Sandinista government. And you got to hand it to them. They were up early and they were organized much more than we were.
On the blowback point, it seems to me that there's a dialectical procedure in operation here such that when globalization comes to a country or intensifies processes already in operation in that country, there is a creation of an elite class. And this elite class, being wealthy, will tend to gain power and thus repress the revolutionary elements within that country. And so the blowback against the United States tends to be prevented from reaching the United States because it stops within national borders by these elite in those countries. So there's a process that prevents blowback from occurring. Now, the terrorist attacks in 9/11 were a kind of exception to that. Somehow they escaped that, maybe through the religious organizing and so on. But in any case, there's inherent processes in globalization itself which prevents blowback from reaching nationalist American shores. In the United States.
That's a good point. Good. Thank you.
Agreeing with Dunbar's Ortiz's comments you send us. This book really was like a reawakening in a lot of ways. I mean, I was amazed at the horror that was inflicted on the folks of Latin America, and realizing that this is also going on in Africa, Asia. And on top of that, the millions of people that are dying every day from starvation, bad medical care, things of that nature. And I've been active in the whole thing for a very long time, and I always consider myself pretty far left. And my old age, I was getting some, I guess, more pacifist ideas and things. Well, I think this sort of put me back on the old track. You know, like policies like the Good Neighbor Policy, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, the hell with them. That this goes on historically over and over and over again. You get heavy attacks on people, and then all of a sudden we get kind of nicer. And then there's heavy attacks on people again, ever since the Founding Fathers. This has been going on over and over again. And as far as I'm concerned, the only way that it's ever really going to end is when the whole damn system is buried and rotting in the grave. I mean, I don't see any other real solution to the whole problem, because this has been going on forever, ever since we landed on Plymouth Rock.
And this is where the example of Cuba is so powerful in the hemisphere. The Cubans simply would not have survived. Whatever people may think about the internal dynamics of what happened in Cuba, what is happening in Cuba. But without an armed population, without, up to a certain point, of course, the demise of the Soviet Union, without Soviet weapons and assistance, they would have been crushed. That kind of assistance was not available to the people in Guatemala. The Sandinistas had to struggle mainly on their own, though I remember I was actually in the heart of the evil empire on November 7th, 1984, when they have the march through Red Square, and I saw some SAM missiles coming by. And I certainly hoped that they were all being sent to Nicaragua, especially so that any time U.S. CIA flights went into Nicaragua, they were going to be shot down. Because I think that the context that we have to understand is that what little opening freedoms, reform, it happened in Latin America, and I would make the same argument anywhere else, happened because people got organized. And some of those struggles were nonviolent. Some of those struggles, people had to take arms up to defend themselves against absolute butchery. Now, we don't have any problem understanding that when it comes to the Warsaw Ghetto or the partisans in Italy. Just watch the magnificent Bertolucci film, 1900, all 5 hours and 15 minutes of it on two discs. We don't have problems understanding the French partisans doing this, the term of resistance of people. And that's the only way the Colossus of the North has been stopped. It has never been stopped by people praying, begging, hoping. And as he even points out, there are historical reasons for the good neighbor policy that were linked to our own Great Depression and resistance movements in Latin America. It has never been that the people who were on the plantations and owning other people's lives sat around and said, well, you know, this is really terrible what we're doing to people. These people's, their children are dying. They don't have any water. You know, that's terrible. We should change that. No, we know, we're adults here. That changed when people organized. And especially when you think of Central America, the level of horror in what happened in those three countries and also in Honduras, where the U.S. was using bases, is, I mean, you know, I spent a lot of time working with Vietnam vets. And I mean, it's horrific. And so I think he's very explicit, very, very explicit about this. And if it wasn't for that genocidal violence, you would have had, you know, probably social democratic governments throughout Central America. You would have had a different area, and you would not have had what we saw in the 1980s. Just no way.
FDR's good neighbor policy was not all that pristine either, but going into a place like Cuba at that time where there was great poverty as well as great wealth, building a huge palace and all the rest of that in the midst of the poverty that was there doesn't reflect to me good neighbor policy. So it seems like I become very suspicious with the good neighbor policy and all the good things that we hear that we're doing because they're usually covering up everything else that's going on.
Do you remember reading about, I mean, I'm sure we do from our, those of us who are older, our high school textbooks and our social studies books about the good neighbors and our wonderful little brown brothers to the south, and we were helping people. And of course, we had no ability to, we weren't helped to analyze this critically to really understand what was going on. I mean, I'm 14 years old in 1954, you know, and I'm worried about other things and who knows what. And this event is destroying the democratic potential. And there was amazing potential and real democracy unfolding from 1944 to 54 in Guatemala. And the U.S. absolutely crushed that. And since that time, so we're talking now 50 plus years, has been an absolute cauldron of violence. And people are still resisting. And of course, millions of people forced to leave Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, many of them in Los Angeles and Southern California. Okay? So, Robert?
Thank you, John. I wanted to mention about this chaos thing, what's happening today. In other words, you're saying when George Bush in Iraq held the banner, mission accomplished, that it was accomplished. You're saying it was accomplished for whatever purpose it is. So I'm just wondering how the left goes about criticizing Bush for whatever or how we do it. And how much chaos do they permit in an area? How much in the Mideast? Is it limited chaos? Or would it, I'm just wondering how much chaos is it that you're saying would be
Well, I don't think I responded briefly because a comment was made in a question and comment about the Middle East and Iraq, but I think it's necessary that we focus and continue to focus on the argument, if it's chaos, about the focus of this book, that is the chaos created throughout Latin America over, as Jim pointed out, from the founding of this country, but especially and dramatically at post-World War II. I mean, it's always been there, but it just took off. And that's why, by the way, I've spent a lot of time on John F. Kennedy. And if some of you have the idea in your head that I'm making an effort to destroy whatever naivete or idealism you have about Kennedy, you're absolutely right. Okay? I was 20 years old in 1960. I was too young to vote. You know, then they lowered the vote. And we were all moved by Kennedy. He actually came to the University of Rochester where I was a student. I saw him speak. I shook his hand. Articulate. You know, I mean, wow. And, you know, Nixon, who, you know, had a beard the way I do, that 5 o'clock shadow. And there was no doubt that he articulated some of the things going on. And if many of us had that, you know, we would have voted for him. And then you start going back and look at what really happened. And as I said, it was Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, all the liberals in that administration that especially organized the terrorist attacks. And that's what they were against Cuba and the rest of Latin America. And they created a chaos and a disruption of family life and culture that's staggering. And, you know, they're having their parties in Washington. And they did the same, as we all know, in Vietnam. And they were arrogant and they pointed like, what's, you know, McNamara to all these charts, et cetera, et cetera. And they would have retained that arrogance had they not been stopped. And that's the difference with Central America, with Vietnam, that the Vietnamese and the U.S. military resistance, especially, and added the U.S. anti-war movement, stopped the U.S. Otherwise, McNamara would have been just as arrogant and would have never, never written a book and, you know, beat his breast about how terrible things happened. And you wouldn't have had this fog of war documentary that Errol What's-His-Name did, which is a wonderful documentary, by the way. It's very powerful. So it's not that Kennedy did something the U.S. had never done before, but he deepened in an amazing, relentless way. And the aid, because we all heard at that time the Alliance for Progress, we're going to help people, they're not going to be poor anymore, we're going to change Latin America. I mean, who heard about the national security state doctrine? Who heard about the death squads being organized? Who the hell knew what the CIA was doing in Guatemala and El Salvador? We didn't know. Some people knew. And so Kennedy, liberal, democratic Kennedy, deepened even far beyond what Nixon and Eisenhower did against those people.
A segue. Because my question is, and it's something I've thought about often, because the election was so close. Nixon lost by 100,000.
I don't know what it was.
Thank you. And you know, many people feel that the election was basically stolen in Illinois because of the ties that Joseph Kennedy had with the syndicate, essentially. But I've always wondered, had Nixon won, given that the Bay of Pigs invasion was essentially an Allen Dulles venture along with the Eisenhower administration, what do you think would have happened had Nixon been elected, do you think that plan would have been carried out? And I guess it's Kennedy's refusal to send in the air support that is spoken of as the reason for the failure of that invasion. So based on that, do you think that Nixon would have carried it out? Or do you think that Nixon would have had a different approach once he attained the White House and was not under Eisenhower's shadow at that point?
We know that it was an amazingly close election, and that certainly Illinois was a critical state, and that it was reputed that people who were dead or otherwise not of this earth voted in Cook County. And it was reputed earlier, I guess, reading some biography or some historical piece on that period in terms of Kennedy beating Humphrey in West Virginia and supposedly connections that his father had to get the primary. So there's the whole issue of the election itself, which was, as Jay said, it was just razor thin. I mean, a few votes here or there. It's a difficult question to answer because on one hand, if you take a totally structuralist analysis that there are these people in power that must maintain capitalism and imperialism, and they're therefore going to be clones of each other, I don't think that helps us understand what happened and what might have happened. On the other hand, we can't indulge ourselves in a sort of individualistic great man. Well, you know, if somebody else had been in this position. I always tend toward a structuralist position that there are real interests to maintain. And of course, the plans were underway. Kennedy was then informed, but Kennedy did not initiate the plans for the Bay of Pigs operation. He went ahead, and there's, you know, real debate about, you know, would it have made a difference if they had air support. Evidently, we know from the released records that all of the so-called things that they expected to happen in Cuba when, you know, these freedom fighters hit the shores, that the Cubans were going to rise up and overthrow Fidel, etc., they were just crushed. And Dulles and others admitted that, well, they just really didn't assess the popularity of the regime, or they were talking to the wrong people, as they usually do. But it seemed to me that in terms of maintaining U.S. interest in Latin America, that Nixon, I would argue, would generally have followed similar policies, because to not do that would really mean that the U.S. would suffer more Cubas. And that was such an absolute dagger. I mean, 90 miles from Florida, to have a country organize itself to move outside of the domination of the United States economically and politically was unheard of. And I don't think any president, given his background and his connections, could allow that to happen again. And we're in a different period today, a historical period. But in that period, they simply could not have another Cuba, which is why they did what they did in Argentina, in Chile, in British Guiana, with Che Guevara. Yeah. I mean, you can't have a group of people begin to organize their own economy on a different ground and take themselves out of the international capitalist order. Because in that sense, I would argue, there is a truth to the domino effect. Because as one country does it, and another country does it, and another country does it, then the U.S. cannot unload its surplus in all these countries. They would then become unfree. They're not by definition. We can't invest our money there. They are not free. And I remember a magnificent essay on the Vietnam War by Carl Oglesby in a book called Containment and Change, in which he argued that the free world is by definition the world that's open to U.S. investment. And therefore, by definition, it's unfree. The rest of the world, the Soviet Union, China, are not free because they block the U.S. from doing anything it wants at one point. Now, of course, you know, China's a different case, but that's another course. I think it would have been because Nixon, you know, I grew up, you know, in a Democratic family, and people hated Republicans and you know, hated Nixon, of course. And Nixon, our image of Nixon is an amazing anti-communist. You know, he worked with Roy Cohen, and he made his whole career out of attacking people and destroying Helen Gahagan Douglas here in California. But a lot of people don't realize that when it came to anti-communist, militaristic views, John Kennedy was right up there with Richard Nixon. But we get Nixon as, and of course, we have the Nixon tapes, and, you know, he went crazy when Allende was, you know, I mean, he's yelling and swearing, that son of a bitch, and then, of course, the Jews were behind it, and we got all the tapes. But Kennedy was cooler, more suave, cleaner, more articulate, et cetera, et cetera. But man, he was right there with the policies.
In 1956, of course, Eisenhower and Nixon were reelected. The planning for the Bay of Pigs started basically in 1958. Richard Nixon was the White House chief action officer for the Bay of Pigs invasion while it was being organized in the Eisenhower administration. Nixon was the lead guy in the White House for Bay of Pigs. I have no doubt that if he had won the election in 1960, he would have been even more, would have been much stronger in the support of it than Kennedy was. When Kennedy won, of course, in 1960, remember, he would have taken office in basically end of January 1961.
Yeah.
Within like a couple of months, I think it was April, was the invasion off.
Yeah, April 17th.
So that would have been February and March, 2 months. They basically walked in, laid it on a table, and said, this is all a fait accompli. It's all set. It's ready to go. And there's, I think, if I remember the number, was there's 2,000 fighters ready to go. The fact was, there were 200 ready to go at the moment. And they just foisted it upon him that it was 2,000 and that the planning was virtually 99% complete, when in fact it was not 99%. They still had a ways to go. So he approved it, but in a backhanded way. He said, I will only approve one flight of U.S. planes over Cuban airfields to destroy their planes, and that's it. Well, of course, we all know the one flight didn't destroy all the planes, and when they requested a second flight, Kennedy said, no, you can't go a second time, and then those folks blamed Kennedy for the failure of Bay of Pigs invasion, when in fact, I think it was a ground battle. You had the farmers driving their tractors to the Bay of Pigs to fight back, along with Fidel and the tanks and all the other militarism. So whether or not the second flight had a matter to do with that is secondary. However, Nixon would have been 100% with that. I mean, if you look at the Whitaker Chambers and his old red baiting thing that he went on, he was four square. He was enraged. Nixon was enraged in 1960 that Kennedy was running to his right during the campaign. He was running as more of a conservative right-wing imperialist, if you will, during the entire campaign, which would lead to it. And that, I mean, who's to argue whether that made the difference in the election? I would doubt very much that it did. But from Nixon's point of view on foreign policy, Kennedy was running to his right. And Nixon was enraged over that, and he certainly would have been 100% involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion. Kennedy was, of course, enraged and fired Bissell. Richard Bissell was fired, along with half a dozen others shortly thereafter. So Kennedy felt totally screwed on the whole deal, even though he had approved it, but it was all happened under Nixon in the White House and Eisenhower.
And we do know now that he certainly, from whatever you may think about Kennedy or the invasion or whatever, I mean, he got really bad advice. And there was incredible incompetence. It's not something unique to the Bay of Pigs invasion for the CIA. But it was amazing coming across that quote of Nixon in the debate telling Kennedy, either in the debate or that he was just absolutely horrified that Kennedy would suggest these kinds of things against Cuba when he, of course, is the point man who's organizing this invasion. You know, and again, we'd be watching the debate. And, of course, whoever were the talking heads after, Huntley, Brinkley, whatever, nobody would have suggested that. And so we had, you know, you had no idea. Wow, Nixon's attacking Kennedy for saying this is outrageous and it's against international law. I mean, he's already planning to do this. I mean, you couldn't invent this stuff. I mean, you really couldn't invent this stuff. This is, I mean, it's like fiction.
Just to amplify your statement about how anti-communist Kennedy was, just a month or two ago, I saw some old documentary on Kennedy running for election, I think, in 1960. And every other word out of his mouth was the communists, we must stop the communists. And I was amazed.
Yeah. And they found out, or he found out early on, if he didn't know before, they gave him some briefings during the campaign that all this crap about the missile gap, etc., was nonsense. It was absolutely nonsense. And at that time, except for the Truman build, except for, you know, the massive buildup in World War II, but in what they call peacetime, okay? And the massive buildup with Truman in 49 and 50, especially after Korea, but Kennedy's buildup in proportional terms was the largest peacetime military buildup in U.S. history. And we already had a lead on the Soviets. I mean, something, you know, we had hundreds and hundreds of ICBMs. They had four, and they were something, I don't know, they were liquid cooled or whatever they were, so that it would take them hours just to get them revved up. And of course, the U.S. satellites could see them anyways. And I'm sure all of you, you know, from the fictionalized version, we remember the great comments in Dr. Strangelove, the movie, about the missile gap and the mineshaft gap. And I'm certain we all remember, those of us old enough, how frightening those moments were in October 1962. Noam Chomsky argues we were one word, one Russian word away from a nuclear war. A Soviet submarine commander refused to fire his missiles. They believed that the submarine was under attack and he would not continue. There was no attack. There was, you know, some problem. Okay, so we were close, and the whole eastern United States, I mean, if the U.S. had bombed and invaded, et cetera, we know now that Fidel's argument would have been they would have launched missiles, and millions and millions and millions of people would have died. But if you don't understand the context of the Cuban Missile Crisis, after hundreds and hundreds of terrorist attacks, a country decides that it has a right to defend itself. So just flip it. If Cuba was the United States, I mean, we wouldn't have a problem saying, you guys keep sabotaging our ports, killing our people, we're going to get these guys to give us some missiles, and we're going to make life miserable for you. I mean, that's the ultimate context. It was Cuba trying to defend itself, as horrendous as that configuration would have been.
I want to touch on about Jimmy Carter, and because I remember this, and you had mentioned it, I kind of like his new book, so I remember back in February 1980, the Alliance for Survival at the time took a full-page ad out in the L.A. Times and got thousands of people down to a fundraiser he was holding in Beverly Hills. And you touched on this, but he did something called Presidential Directive 59, and it was changing the direction of our nuclear-tipped missiles from going to a populace in the Soviet Union to their missile sites. Now, ordinarily, that might sound good. You know, we don't want to destroy people, but it really enabled us to do potential first-strike capability at the time. So we were out protesting, and that was one of the most devastating changes of policy ever in the whole beginning realm of the anti-nuclear weapons movement throughout the 80s and before.
And maybe let's finish on that, because I think that since he left the White House, Carter's done a lot of very remarkable things. He's sure as hell put his neck out with this book, and he is catching hell in a lot of places. And, you know, through the Carter Center and through efforts to negotiate and work on elections around the country and Habitat for Humanity, I would argue, as an ex-president, a former president, I think he's far in excess of what anybody else has done. But having said that, I would make the same claim that I have about Kennedy and Walton has, that even though Carter took a lot of lumps, especially from conservatives in the right wing, when we look at Carter's actual years at the helm, his watch in terms of U.S. imperialism, his record is outrageous and I would argue even criminal in terms of, I mean, he was begged by Cardinal Romero, Archbishop Romero, to not continue to send arms to El Salvador. It was Carter who continued to support the Shah in Iran. It was on Carter's watch, by the way, that Daniel Moynihan at the UN blocked any effort by the United Nations to deal with the genocidal attacks by the Indonesians on East Timor. And it was a Carter, of course, before the Soviet Union really got involved in Afghanistan. And Brzezinski has now admitted this, that but Carter was not the, I would argue, not the almost macho, anti-communist figure that Kennedy was. As dangerous as he was, because anyone becoming president of the United States is, I would argue, by implication, extremely dangerous. As you said, you know, he can just decide we're going to do this with missiles. So people need to rethink Carter through just the way they need to rethink Kennedy. And of course, Carter comes up, you know, his policy was human rights, and on some things he was better, of course, than Reagan. Let's go home.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.